Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yeah. Did you bring some water?
Oh, my gosh. I have three sips left in my still
seat. Oh, my God. Perfect.
It's lukewarm and disgusting, but it's water.
Yeah. I think about that. It's like, oh, that's got to be gross.
I know. Every time somebody's like, and then he took a drink of water, and I'm like, ugh.
Heck yeah. Dune by Frank Herbert in episode 141. This is episode 141. Yeah. So how do you like Dune?
I love Dune.
All right. Yes, me
it
too.
It is such a great book. I've read, how many times have you read it?
This would be my third, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was realizing I don't know how many times I've read this book. Not so many that I have it memorized. And on Goodreads, I was looking and I marked in 2010 that I had read it. So that's the last time. But I know I read it several times as, you know, college age. I think my parents had it around the house.
Yeah, my first time, it's a pretty clear memory because I've been wanting to read this book for a long time. And I had tried and stopped a few times.
Oh.
And then it was in college, and I had to take a bus home. So from Tucson to Idaho took like 30 hours.
Oh, my gosh.
So I brought it, and I read the whole thing. Yeah. I smelled like cigarettes, but I had finished the book. But I remember reading it. Yeah, it's a really clear memory. That was the first time I had read it, so...
Well, I have to say, this time might be the most vivid time because, for one thing, I was reading it for our discussion. So, you know, you pay attention more, or I do. And for the other thing is, I was also listening, as I'd mentioned before, that to the Mythgard Academy set of classes. I think they're a set of 12.
Yeah.
Two-hour classes.
Wow.
That Corey Olson did. Yes, sometimes he goes on a bit. You know, he get to the poetry and I go, wait, if I skip ahead 20 minutes, oh, that's not long enough. Okay. But he would, you know, of course, ask questions about things. He's a real good teacher that way, just kind of letting it sit there to see what people say. And so it made me aware of some things that I hadn't paid attention to before because I've always read this strictly for the story.
Mm, yeah.
Not for the other stuff that's roiling below the surface.
Yeah, it's a good story. Mm-hmm. Have you read past this one?
No.
Okay.
This was enough, I felt.
Gotcha.
But you have, right?
Well, I've read Dune Messiah, but I had intended to read Children of Dune because he intended them. I mean, when he thought of the story, the three were the one. So Dune Messiah, and Children of Dune were one thing to him. And I saw that in an interview. So, but yeah, so I've read Dune Messiah, but I just haven't got to Children of Dune. I can't explain why. It's just one of those things that I never got to. But well, Dune is just really, really great, and Dune Messiah is, well, I'm going to say less great, but we'll talk a little bit about it later, I'm sure, because what happens there is kind of important. And I think it is part of his point, at least. But the thing is, you know, Dune has, it is complex. You know, there's lots of points, I guess. There's not like a single overriding point. But he did have, you know, when he talked about Dune, Frank Herbert, that is, when Frank Herbert talked about Dune, he always brought up this main point, which was... He was exploring the effect of a messiah on a society, but the aspect that interested him was not so much the messiah himself. It was the structure that builds up around the person that the person can't control.
Well, that's interesting because I felt... In this book, as I have never felt it before, that the main thing that's being looked at here is choice versus destiny, which is in essence free will versus destiny.
Yes, and that's super perceptive too as to what happens later.
Okay, well, because I was thinking, I guess I should look at the Wikipedia summaries to see what happens, because every time I have read this before, I felt, okay, so if you haven't read this book, we're obviously just diving right in.
Yes.
I have felt that Paul is a triumphant figure at the end. You know, he's on his way, he can do what he wants to make things better. And reading it this time, as I said, paying attention to things where I was like, why did I never notice this before? I did not feel that way. I felt that he was flawed in a very crucial manner. I felt that he kind of, because of the choices he'd made before and the way it showed him unwilling to sacrifice himself fully for what he believed, that he was set up for failure because he couldn't be an effective leader if you weren't willing to really sacrifice and care about people.
Cool. Yeah.
I don't know if that's what happened.
That's super interesting. Yeah, that's great. It's great. So cool. So let's do talk a little bit about the plot really quick, as if we can do that really quick. So Mythgard did that in 24 hours and we're going to do it in a minute.
I'm looking at the back of my book going, even they don't try to do it. They just go, this is that super cool book that you've heard of. That's won a lot of awards, everybody.
That's
here
right.
Here you go.
That's right. So, yeah, it was published in 1965. It is complex, and it was kind of unique for its time. There was a blurb by Arthur C. Clarke on a version that I had that compared it to Lord of the Rings. In fact, the blurb was, I know nothing to compare this with other than Lord of the Rings. And I think that he was talking about the sheer world-building aspect of it.
Well, also, I would say the under-the-surface things that move the people around is kind of very interesting also.
Yeah, yeah. Lots of undercurrents. Lots
like Lord of the Rings.
Right,
yeah,
lots
the choices
of, lots of things do. Going on. And lots of deliberation. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on in their heads where we're in there, you know, and we can hear what they're thinking about, who they're talking to, and the decisions that they're making. Very, very complex webs upon webs type of a thing.
Yeah.
One interesting thing I'll say here that I thought was personally interesting anyway, he couldn't find a publisher for Dune.
Oh, really?
He kept sending him to publishers, and they would say, yeah, this is... you know, really kind of amazing, but we're not going to publish it. And then the house that published it was Chilton, the guys who do the auto manuals.
Oh my gosh, really?
It was Chilton, yeah. That was the first edition of Dune was Chilton Books.
He didn't have The Hobbit to lead the way. That was his problem.
right.
Could the Lord of the Rings... had an expectant audience and publisher if The Hobbit hadn't, you know, been such a bestseller. Probably not.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So, okay, so what is it about? Well, it's about, well, there's a universe, there's different houses. The main two houses that are talked about in this book are the House Atreides and the House Harkonnen, who are bitter enemies. And when the book opens, Paul Atreides is on his home planet of Caladan, which has lots of water. You know, you feel like you got to mention that. Okay. And then there's this planet called Arrakis, which is Dune. So Dune is like a nickname for this planet Arrakis, which is one big desert. And the most important thing about Dune is that it generates spice. And the spice has a lot of properties that it seems to be in use, like, for all kinds of things. one of them is space travel, right? There has something to do with, how we can get through space. In the distant past, by the way, there was a big... machine versus man war.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah, and so that's why computers are not a big thing in this story. In fact, you know, I don't even know that they come up. But there's like a commandment, you know, thou shalt not build a machine in man's image.
Well, and they have, as a result, a group of people who are called Mentats, and they make you think of a Mr. Spock type character. Although the one Mentat we're allowed to see the most is terribly flawed at how he does his job. Of course, he's pretty old.
Yeah, yeah.
But so, you know, there's the human element that's even in that. But yeah, yeah.
Right. So the Mentats are like human computers. They're at the side of leaders and, you know, if they're lucky enough to have one on their staff. And these guys calculate and, you know, plot and strategize. And
yeah, and they can set themselves aside from all the facts and kind of look at where the patterns go. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of these special – sorry, go ahead.
No, no.
I was just going to say there's a lot of these special groups like the Bene Gesserit, who we meet pretty quickly.
Yeah,
so these are a group of women. You know, they call them witches, right? Bene Gesserit witch, but it's usually an epithet, right?
Right. They're like a religious order, really. Mm-hmm,
really.
You feel like, I mean, the way they – don't they have a mother superior? Isn't that who comes and
– yeah. What do you call it? The Reverend Mother.
Reverend right? Mother. That's
Reverend
it.
Mother. But it seems like there could be more than one Reverend Mother. It was an achievable state or whatever of a Bene Gesserit.
One of the interesting things is looking at this world and thinking about he uses a lot of familiar, would you call them archetypes or whatever, to kind of communicate a sense of the things. So like when you look at the Fremen who live on Arrakis, you're kind of going, oh, some Arab words are being used. And in the 1960s, of course, that would have – a lot of those things weren't nearly as familiar concepts as they might be now to us, like jihad and that kind of thing. And so in on the one sense, like Reverend Mother and that kind of thing, he's using that to kind of give you an overall quick sense and entry into kind of where he's going with it. But on the other hand – you can't allow that identification to just be the only thing you think about, because he's also then just using those as springboards to go where he wants to go. You know, that's, you know, he may be using Arab culture, desert culture on Dune, but that's not what he's doing, really. Yeah. He's not making a I didn't feel like he was making commentaries on those things so much as just going, here are the cultures I've got set up.
Yeah.
You may not agree. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. So there's some cultural cues that he uses for shortcuts. But you're right. This is
what
not
an elegant way to put it.
Yeah, this is not an Arabic culture, right? Mm-hmm. Even though some of the words are there. And there would be some similarities.
Yeah, and the Reverend Mother, this isn't even – and they use the Orange Catholic Bible. But they are not Catholic. And you don't know that Catholics are really – or this Bible is really what we're used to.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there are things in it that we do recognize and things in it that we don't. But it kind of gives you a sense of so far in the future.
Right, yeah.
Here's
thousands
what this is
kind
of all mutated into.
Tens
yeah.
of thousands of years.
Yeah.
I think it actually is supposed to be, you know, like 20,000 years or something like
that. I believe
it. Yeah. It doesn't – I mean, it doesn't explicitly say it, you know. But so there's familiarity with our world, but it's a long time from now. Galaxy far, far away.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah.
And yet human beings are still
and yet we're still
yeah.
I feel like we've talked about that before. How disappointing that we're still
get away with it.
Yeah. Incredible.
Well, that's maybe my sense of failure with Paul is, you know, I had thought of him one way, and then I kind of look at what's underneath the surface and go, oh, damn it.
Right.
He's the same flawed person that we all are.
That's right. That's right.
Despite being the I can't say it, but the Messiah, essentially.
Right, right. Yeah, so.
It's Haderach or whatever.
Yeah, Kwisatz Haderach, right, which is kind of an ultimate being that it's almost like a genetic engineering or, I don't know, is it called eugenics when they're just trying to select? I'm not sure if I have the right word, But, you know, but mm-hmm. it's like the Bene Gesserit. One of the things that they're doing is they're trying to create this super being through mm-hmm. breeding, really. So they do selective breeding where it's like this huge breeding project. But yeah. Jessica, who is Paul's mom, kind of messed up their plan by doing her own thing. So Paul, I guess we should say who Paul is. Paul, at the opening of the book, he is Paul Atreides. So he's with the House Atreides. His dad is the Duke. And the Duke's concubine is Jessica. And Paul is Jessica's son.
Mm-hmm.
And the Harkonnens, again, the mortal enemies of the Atreides, they had control of Arrakis. And through some political machinations, the Atreides are going to take over the planet Arrakis and are in the process at the opening of the book of moving to Arrakis. And the Harkonnens are moving off Arrakis back to their home planet, Gedi Prime or something like that. I can't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. A very, very dark place. Because Harkonnens are very, very evil.
Yeah. It's psychically horribly dark.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, this author is not afraid to make a villain who you really can't stand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I would say, yeah, so what happens is there's this big political struggle going on, and somewhere the emperor is involved, and as people make comments about the emperor and various things happen, you start to see the maneuvering that's going on because it's a huge feudal system.
Mm.
And so once they get to the planet, there's this time where it's an interesting time of maneuvering.
Yeah.
As they learn about the house and you learn more about Duke Leto and Jessica and all these and Paul and everything and their retainers, essentially. And then it just erupts into this violence as there's essentially the Harkonnens in disguise take over everything and, you know, do their best to take over everything again and wipe out the Atreides. And Jessica and Paul have to take to the hills and to the desert. And essentially, this is There's an elegant word, but I can't think of it. It's the thing that pushes Paul into realizing his potential as that Messiah type character who's a man who can see the mystical stuff that the ladies in the Bene Gesserit have always been able to see.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, he doesn't, unfortunately, use it the way the Bene Gesserit thought, which is the problem with trying to, you know, maneuver your own Messiah into place.
Exactly, yeah. Right. And then after the Harkonnens, like you said, along with the Emperor,
mm-hmm.
Do quite a lot of damage to the Atreides. Paul and his mother end up on the planet among the, I guess, the natives who were called the Fremen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Out there in the desert. And a lot of the book takes place in that. And then there's confrontation. I guess that's the plot synopsis. There's a big confrontation at the end.
Yeah, because it's all about the spice, really, and mm-hmm. who controls it. And so, and also, we left out an elemental thing, which is these sandworms, which are the neatest idea ever.
Yeah, very cool.
Gigantic. And they'll come in response to any kind of a rhythmical noise in the desert because they want to eat whatever's there.
Yeah.
So the Fremen are continually eluding them and maneuvering around the way they want.
Yeah, that was really cool. Yeah. Like I said, a really cool idea. And you know, when you're describing that, I realize I can't say my favorite part of the book, but one of my favorite parts of the book was their first days on Arrakis.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked, you know, they're in the mm-hmm. house, they're exploring the house. Jessica found that garden with all the water in it, and there was a message for her in there.
Yeah, encoded on the back of a leaf because it was pointing the wrong way.
Exactly,
and it was, like,
and it was from a Bene Gesserit who was in the Harkonnen house.
Yeah,
and so you're seeing these connections and loyalties and plans, and it's just I thought it was just so well done. And we're moving into spoiler territory, right?
If we haven't already,
but the attempt on Paul's life, get to see Paul, how capable he is during that,
And the kind of training that they've put people through because they know these kind of attacks will go on, and in that way, it's a very medieval kind of an idea too.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. And then you get to meet some of the Fremen that are servants in the house, especially the shout-out Mapes, who I love.
Who doesn't love her? Yeah. The way she picks up that bull's head that's going to be mounted on the wall and goes, "Killed an old duke, did you?" You know, just like, I love that.
Yeah, I do love that. So I do love that. Have you seen the David Lynch version of Dune?
No.
The movie? You haven't seen it?
No, I guess you have.
Well, of course, yeah, I've seen it a few times. It's not like the best movie ever. I mean, it's almost. I mean, some people say Dune is unfilmable, but they keep trying to do it. But the there's a lot of images in that movie that I think that just stick with me. And the shout out Mapes. I'm trying to remember who played her. It was a famous actress, and she was just so good. I've got to look it up. I'm sorry. Dune.
Yeah, no, that's...
Lynch, IMDb. anyway, this movie is worth seeing because I think it was groundbreaking in some ways. It will change your... Remember, there was somebody who I talked to in the past who said he doesn't like to watch movies with Jesus in it because he feels that the images will intrude his mind and disturb the images he's built up over the years.
Okay.
So, I mean, but I guess I say that because once you watch this, at least when I saw it, now when I read the book, these are the images in my head, all of these people.
Well, kind of like The Lord of the Rings, and we've discussed that too. And it's funny because in The Lord of the Rings, I'll rereading it now, I'll go back and forth between the images I had and then some of the images for the other stuff that were in the movies. And I tend to feel that way about things like Jane Eyre and, you know, books that I'm really in love with that I've read and have these ideas established. But for me, it tends not to be so much what the people look like.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes I'm like, oh, you know, Aragorn, welcome Viggo Mortensen to my mental gallery. But it does tend to be things like where they've messed up the story.
Right, right. Yeah. And to put this into a 2-hour movie, you can imagine what they had to do.
They need to let Peter Jackson loose on this.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, it would be, do a Game of Thrones treatment on this. But there has been a miniseries. Linda Hunt. That's it. Yeah, Linda Hunt was a shout out mate. She was perfect.
I would never have thought of that, but she does. I could see it. Yeah.
Right. Right. No, it's good. So that's why I said, you know, hey, she reminds me of Mother Teresa. That's the image in my head of the shout out Mapes.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So in that book, really she's like wearing veils and stuff.
Yeah, kind of in my head, but I don't know that she is. Isn't she wearing? Well, no. In the house, she's not wearing her still suit.
No.
No, she's not.
That's
so
the luxury as she. But yeah. Oh my gosh, this is so great.
Yeah.
No still suit.
Right, and then her reaction. I love the detail where. You know, they were saying, well, you know, the Harkonnens used to use these towels. They'd fill them with water and then just throw them on the ground. And then people outside would just come and try and get a squeezing of water from these towels.
Right. And they'd sell it.
Right. Vegas. And, you know, shout out Mapes was clearly not impressed with that. But I just loved how that whole part of the book... All of the stuff that was revealed and how he did it and things like those details. And then that room itself, what we talked about a little bit earlier with where Jessica goes in there and they've got this garden that has just got running water in it. And,
yes.
How horrible that was. I mean, it was beautiful and horrible. Decadent. Yeah, yeah, it was just decadent. And it's like, you know, being just ridiculously rich amongst a whole bunch of poor people. Yeah.
I know. Is there anything that could better have mentally described to you how arid and desert-like it was outside and then how rich these people were? Mm. It was such a wonderful image.
Yeah.
You right. know, and I agree. I really loved that whole thing. I mean, I loved their dinner party where everybody's talking in coded things and you're seeing what Paul understands and what Jessica understands and what maybe I can't remember Duke Leto. I don't think we're in his head at that point. But as the conversation goes on and people go, oh, that's a code. Oh, Paul knows that, you know, and what better description of not only a very layered social situation, which is what they'd run into anyway, but also the practical uses that that Bene Gesserit training is put to.
Yeah.
And what Jessica as a concubine could bring to Duke Leto in terms of her training and advice and everything.
Yeah.
And insights to him.
Yeah, that was just terrific. So incredibly well done.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, and Duke Leto too, trying to navigate it.
What a guy.
I mean, you know, we could feel doom coming, right?
Yeah. Oh,
I mean, it was just like, oh, there was boy.
Impending doom yeah. all over the place.
Right.
They were just, and they knew it, and they even kind of, and they even knew how it was coming.
Hmm.
You know, they even said the, you know, it's going to look like the, like Harkonnen or whatever, but it's going to be the Emperor's shock troops or the other way around. I can't remember now at this point. I should. But I can't. But anyway, so, and that's a point that Corey Olson made over and over, which I never thought about. He's like, you know, some books, it's for the surprise of what's going to happen. He goes, this book, they tell you, he's continually telling you flat out up front what's going to happen. And he goes, and it's amazing that it's still as gripping as it is. Because, you know, they're like, oh, who is the traitor? Well, it should be Dr. Yue or however you say his name, but he's got this super training. And so we'll just never look at him. Well, of course it is him.
Yeah.
You right. know, it's that it's here's the inevitable coming, but they think themselves out of understanding how it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a real interesting way to write a book, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is, I think one of the reasons that it is so gripping is because we know who it is, but they don't.
Right.
Right. And so yeah, that's the that's surprise. It. There's still a revelation to the other characters where, you know, when the Duke, yeah, when Yue confronts the Duke, you know, in that time and puts in the tooth and yeah, that was, you know, makes the bargain with him.
Well, you know, and in that sense, that's interesting. This just occurred to me is we are in that case put into the same mindset as Paul when later on when his powers are blooming and he can see, you know, like it's a millisecond and he's been able to see all these paths in outside of time, which way he should take and what's going to happen if he does all these things. And but still, he'll get to these places where it's a nexus. I don't know what's going to happen. Or he'll be surprised by somebody attacking him or something because he'll go, I didn't foresee this.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, we're like, Paul, we can see where the book's going. It tells us where it's going. But it's the different choices people make and how they react. And like with the tooth, like you said, or different outcomes of how is Paul going to fight Jameis, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know. So we're drawn in by the details.
Right, right. You know, one of the themes I think in this, like you said earlier, is brought up by him being able to see paths.
Mm-hmm.
What about, you know, freedom of choice, human freedom? If we could see the path, if we could see what our lives were going to be like in the future, what does that do to your freedom of action?
Well, and that brings up an interesting point because we see Paul, and in some ways we're limited because we only see certain things from Paul's point of view. He's the only one who can see how jihad is looming in the future, how inevitable it is, And he'll do things and go, it's never going to come to jihad. I am not going to be the one who sets this loose on the universe. And so he's continually fighting against what seems inevitable. But there are, at least what I could see, there are a couple of places where he could have made a choice that would have changed everything. He could have let Jameis kill him. Now, I don't think these things are natural human choices, and that's why he didn't make them. He wants to have a life. He wants to be with Chani, if that's how you say her name. Mm-hmm. He wants to, you know, he loves his mother, despite the fact that he's like, she's going to bring jihad. So if he had let Jameis kill him, it would have been done. And if he had, at his threat at the end to everybody, he's going to blow up the spice. If he had done that, it would have been done. But see, those involved sacrifices he himself did not want to make. So he's going around going, well, I guess jihad's finally inevitable. I just can't fight it. No, he either wasn't evaluating what he could really do in a selfless way, or he just couldn't see it himself because he was so close to all the choices that had to be made.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
You know, he mm-hmm. could use his free will. And then when you speak of, you know, Messiah and, you know, he's a Christ figure in a way, or he's certainly, to me, he's a prophet. He's a flawed prophet for that very reason. He's doing the best he can, but he won't submit him. If he thinks this choice is really the way to go, he's not going to put himself 100% into it. He's selfish. We're all selfish, and I'm not condemning him for that. I'm just saying he's selfish, and that's what stops him from achieving his real goal.
Interesting. So who is he a prophet of?
Of the religion that's going to arise, of Paul Maud Dibb,
mm-hmm.
that sets everybody with the black and green, Atreides banner boiling out into the galaxy to make the race happy.
To make the race happy.
Oh, please. I have to say, you know how you've mentioned before where you'll go, every time I hit this thing, oh, it was in Dante. Every time I hit the space travel, it jerked me out of the book, right?
Right, right, yeah.
And I don't know how I've read this book so many times and never noticed race consciousness and Paul's terrible purpose that are boiling under the surface. And this time, though, race consciousness is something that I really suddenly noticed. And the more I went on, the more I went, hold on. Race consciousness seems to be getting more and more personified until it gets to this one point in the book where it's like, and the race consciousness can feel this happening and it's going to do this. And I was like, every time that happened, I was like, oh, I hate you, Frank Herbert, so much. Because I'm just going to say it. If you're going to have a prophet or a messiah, therefore, they have to really believe in something. You know, what are they representing? In this book, they're representing this race consciousness nonsense. Yeah, I said it. And so essentially, that's taking something like evolution and making it mindful.
Yeah, so is there some kind of a collective unconscious, like directing the evolution of humanity? And yeah, it's personified, but it's not God.
Yes, because he doesn't have the guts, in my opinion, to I hear the protests come from everybody, but he doesn't have the guts to actually let there be God. So what does he have to do? He puts this race consciousness thing in here. And so you've got this part of the book toward the end where he says, even the faint gaps were closed now. And this is Paul thinking, here was the unborn jihad. Here was the race consciousness that he had known once as his own terrible purpose. Here was reason enough for a Kwisatz Haderach or a Lisan al-Ghaib, or even the halting schemes of the Bene Gesserit. The race of humans had felt its own dormancy, sensed itself grown stale, and knew now only the need to experience turmoil in which the genes would mingle and the strong new mixture survive. All humans were alive as an unconscious single organism in this moment, experiencing a kind of sexual heat that could override any barrier. And Paul saw how futile were any efforts of his to change any smallest bit of it. And I'm like, oh, give me a break. me. I'm sorry.
No.
You may not feel that way. No, but don't I was be sorry. Like, are you freaking kidding me? This mm-hmm. is like saying the sparrow picked to have brown feathers because, hey, guys, let's all get together. You know what? They don't see us as well if we have these little brown feathers. Let's do this. No. Evolution and, you know, the way that race or whatever goes is not conscious. I don't care, Dr. Jung or whoever this comes from.
Yeah, the collective unconscious. But I don't think Jung thinks that it is, you know, something that directs.
Oh, no.
Yeah, he's like, we all have this common, you know, what's the word? You know, so the collective unconscious isn't that. That's, we all have commonalities. And
which I'm totally on board with.
Right, right. Yeah.
You know, and especially as a Christian, mm-hmm. you say, this yeah. is the way we're made.
Exactly.
I mean,
yeah.
you know, it's, we have these things built in.
Mm-hmm.
Whether through evolution or through God, you know, creating us in his own image originally, mm-hmm. you know, the whatever mechanism he used.
Yeah.
But, yeah. But one thing he didn't do was go, and now the race is going to just be its own thing because we've gotten a bit stale. The Bene Gesserits have been tinkering around trying to make this happen. Well, they did. And guess what? I don't like what you've been doing, Bene Gesserit. We're going to mix it up. No more breeding programs. Okay, I realize I'm being simplistic, but I was, every time it came up, I was like, oh, have the courage of your convictions or make it work. That did not work for me.
Yeah, fascinating.
Rebuttal?
No, I don't really have a rebuttal.
Spur of the moment.
I can't disagree. You know, I certainly don't feel like, you know, that's a conscious thing. On its own volition, right? Mm-hmm. You know, God's in there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't know. I guess it didn't strike me as hard as it did you. But it is kind of a new agey sort of way of looking yeah. at humanity.
Well, and it's interesting because I totally love the whole idea of what's choice versus fate. And he had such an elegant way of putting it. Again, this was called to mind for me by Corey Olson. But I had already noticed this stuff. But when Duke Leto's dying, mm-hmm. and it's telling us what he's seeing as he's dying or what he's thinking. And that's so interesting. And it says, one thought remained to him. Leto saw it in formless light on rays of black. The day the flesh shapes and the flesh the day shapes. The thought struck him with a sense of fullness he knew he could never explain. So we know it's important. Mm-hmm. It's a very last thing. And he doesn't necessarily, he understands it. But it's not something he's been contemplating before, so it's something new. And that right there is destiny versus choice, the day the flesh shapes and the flesh the day shapes.
Mm-hmm.
So the choices versus, you know, your experiences and everything else around you that make you have to make those choices.
Right, yeah.
And that juxtaposed with what gets brought up at the very beginning, which is the Reverend Mother testing Paul to see if he's human. So the whole time you've had it defined as, you know, the human being is will not chew off its foot if it's caught in a trap. It'll wait and see if it can find a way around it and be tricky. And mm-hmm. That's where you start to see people talking about what does it mean to be a ruler? What does it mean to be human? And, of course, the great irony is that they're running a breeding program like people are animals.
Right.
So but that whole idea of, so what does it mean to be human? And choice versus fate or destiny.
Yeah. Right. And that stuff comes up later in the books too. So, yeah, I'm told, well, I've read a synopsis of Children of Dune.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I should get into that. But there is something in there where, a golden path is seen.
Mm-hmm.
It says here in Children of Dune, he has Paul's son, Leto. So, spoilers, apologies.
Oh, yeah.
View the golden path, the only way for humanity to survive the next 3,000 years. But then Leto, it's really what you're saying. He has to make decisions that put that right into the forefront, you know, destiny versus your own free will.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's good stuff. Now, let's see what I was talking about earlier with the Messiah and the structure that comes around.
Oh yeah.
So what he said is, this is in an interview that I have. It came out in a Walden Books cassette way back when, and I've had it ever since.
Cassette.
Yeah, cassette. So he said when he was writing Dune, what he wanted was something that showed the impact of a Messiah on history as the creator of a power structure. His theory was that a Messiah creates a power structure that attracts corruptible people, no matter how well-meaning the Messiah might be. This led into a discussion about how a Messiah is accepted by a culture in the first place, and this is some stuff that I wrote a while back. But then, so in Dune Messiah, in fact, it's kind of a famous story in science fiction because Frank Herbert wrote Dune, and John W. Campbell, the famous editor, published Dune. The first appearance of Dune was in Analog Magazine.
Oh.
Then it was published in book form by Chilton.
Okay.
Okay, and then he wrote Dune Messiah, and John W. Campbell hated it so much that he would not put it in Analog. He had to sell it to Galaxy. So he sold it to Galaxy Magazine.
That really makes me wonder what it's like, because I always have had a sneaking sympathy for a lot of John W. Campbell's choices.
Yeah. He did a good job. I mean, what can I say? I mean, I love the science fiction from that era.
Yeah.
So from the book Dreamer of Dune, which is like a biography of Frank Herbert, Brian, his son, wrote, "Among the dangerous leaders of human history, my father sometimes mentioned General George S. Patton because of his charismatic qualities, but more often his example was President John F. Kennedy. Around Kennedy, a myth of kingship formed and of Camelot. His followers did not question him and would have gone with him virtually anywhere." So that's the dangerous stuff that Frank Herbert wanted to write about.
Oh my gosh, what would he have done with...
Yeah, exactly.
Recent
exactly. I mean, which is maybe why I thought of Dune in the first place.
We're caught in the crosshairs of that right now.
Both American political
parties have got those sorts of people and those sorts of followers in place.
Yeah, and blind.
Oh,
blind,
both sides.
Blind both sides. Yeah. So... but this is what he talked about, and he talked about it in relation to John F. Kennedy in the interview, where he was just saying, you know, the effect of a charismatic leader on society is extremely dangerous. And it's not only dangerous because of this blind following, but it's dangerous because of the structure that appears around the person. And the structure is not controllable. And that's what he was saying. So when he wrote Dune Messiah is like the fall of Paul Atreides for some of the flaws that you said. It's like an anti-hero. So, so John W. Campbell wrote in a note to Frank Herbert, "The reactions of science fictioneers, however, over the last few decades have persistently and quite explicitly been that they want heroes, not anti-heroes. They want stories of strong men who exert themselves, inspire others, and make a monkey's uncle out of malign fates!" Exclamation point. So this is John Campbell writing to him. He's saying, "I do not like this because..." This guy's not who we thought, you know, it should be a book about something even more awesome than the last one. But instead, Frank Herbert yanked the rug right out from under Paul and stuff was being done around him by his structure. People were being killed in his name without him being able to control it, you know. And so, that is the danger that Frank Herbert wanted to write about in this entire thing.
So if we look at it from Lord of the Rings, John Campbell wanted Aragorn in what Frank Dune was doing was, or Frank Dune, Frank Herbert was doing, Frank Dune Herbert was giving him Boromir.
Yeah.
I mean, essentially.
That's funny. Yeah, absolutely.
It's
kind
of interesting. It's absolutely. Who you allow to run things and what do they find? Do they find redemption in the flaws that they have? Because as you're talking, and I was thinking about power structures and his wanting to investigate that, because I was thinking, you know, there was a structure for a messiah set up already that Paul drops into and then runs with, which is Liet Kynes.
Right.
I don't know how you say that. The planetary ecologist who wants only to transform the planet, which I thought was just a genius goal for everybody, you know?
Yeah.
And then also Paul is contrasted with his father very strongly. And his father, because of the incident where the worms are coming and the spice crawlers are going to be lost, and he's like I care, get those men out of here. We have to save the men. And I can't remember if it's Kynes or whoever's with him who's like, this is somebody who could inspire blind devotion. I could follow him.
Yeah.
But Paul later on is something happens, and I can't remember what it is. And Paul's like, well, we can recover. And maybe it was at Gurney Halleck. Some retainer says, you know, your father would have cared about the people. And he's like, yeah, whatever. Moving on. And so what you're starting to see is he's not the man his father was. He's more like the old duke.
Right.
He would stand there, take on the bull, and then turn his back to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's because of his own hubris that he does these things.
Yeah, that's such a good point. Yeah.
Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah, so it all crumbles around him.
Yeah, so it's not just the, yeah, it's the being followed blindly, but what are the qualities that make men follow you blindly? Paul has these attributes of, you know, the foreknowledge and all everything, but as a person, who is he? He gets power so young that he's not had the necessary hardships to overcome some of maybe his selfish qualities or whatever other qualities there are that are his problem areas, because we've all got them. And something else I thought was interesting in the book, because you're on a desert planet, is it keeps getting brought up that to be soft is to die. Hardship is what hones you into a brilliant blade or into somebody who's who you should be. And Jessica brings this up all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was struck by that because that's not something that we see nowadays. Nowadays, everybody's like, oh, we should make it as easy as possible. No one should have
Well, that's a very Catholic viewpoint too. I mean, you know, the suffering, the value of suffering. And, you know, but yeah, we spend an awful lot of time as a society avoiding suffering right now. It's difficult. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that thing that there's something to be said also for the acceptance that suffering exists and we're going to have suffering on whatever level, however small or large.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there, every day brings something we don't like. There's no perfect day. And we have to choose to overlook it, to kind of embrace it and use it if we can, which is part of the offering it up concept of saying, as I suffer through this, can you, Jesus, unite my suffering to yours on the cross and offer it to God? Do something good with my suffering, whether for me or someone else or whatever. And that's almost that concept here.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt. Yeah.
And
that's
when you
neat.
Do that, when you embrace it, I mean, it doesn't mean you don't have to try to fix things. It doesn't mean, you know, it's you're not lying down like a doormat. But sometimes you just can't get out of stuff. And so when you embrace it like that and just go, I don't get it. I hate it. But use it to make me a better person or use it somehow. Or thank you.
Yeah.
I can't see far enough for this, but I'm gonna trust you, God, that whatever I'm trying to get out of right now, there's a bigger purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Acceptance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It makes a huge difference in living your own
life. Yeah, and that's
life.
I don't know, it all ties together, doesn't it? It's like, you know, we're talking about destiny versus free will.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, acceptance of what is. It's all tied into one big theme.
Yeah, and do you have the bigger goal in mind? We don't always.
Mm-hmm.
We'd like to say we do. A lot of times we're just selfish people.
Right.
But, and I'm thinking of myself here in the last few days, especially with just struggling with little stuff.
Hmm.
How can that little stuff be so awful?
Yeah.
And yet when you just kind of go, oh, I'm being awful. I will sacrifice this thing I'd rather have so this other person can be happy, even if it's something I don't like. There's a real freedom and peace in that. And that's, we never see Paul having that.
Right.
I mean, he's struggling against jihad. That's a good thing to struggle against. But he never stops and says, what can I personally sacrifice to make this not happen?
Yeah. You know, and we think about, you know, we don't have the benefit of knowing what plans, you know, if there's God's plan or knowing what the future is or knowing what we're going to do. And here we have Paul who does have that, but it's not a benefit. It's not at all a benefit. It's destructive. And yeah, it could be enhancing his flaws.
Yeah. Because every time he hits the blind nexus, like fighting Jameis or whatever it is, he's continually doing what any of us would try to do. I want to win the fight.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Even though most of the paths he sees winds up with him lying dead on the floor. Of course he wants to win. Anybody wants to stay alive. And he's protecting his mother, you know? But that is the path to jihad.
Right.
Is it better to sacrifice yourself for the many?
Mm-hmm.
Essentially.
Yep.
But can he see it like that? Because in that moment, he's dropped into, he's a whatever, 15-year-old boy, whatever his training has been.
Yeah, probably he is not. Young. Yeah, probably not. Mm-hmm. So, wow. This has not been nearly enough time to talk about Dune. We probably need another three-parter.
No.
But is there anything else you wanted to be sure to bring up?
Well, the one other thing was that, again, this is something I picked up from Mythgard Academy, which wouldn't have occurred to me. You know, when they get to this planet, Jessica notices that, you know, they're going, oh, you're fulfilling the prophecy. Hmm. And these various things will happen and different people will go, oh, the prophecy. And she'll go, oh, you know, the Bene Gesserit have been here and they planted these various versions of prophetic Messiah prophecies everywhere. And so she can go, it's kind of like, oh, prophecy 21. Got it. So she'll say things that tie into the prophecy so she can use them for her own benefit. But the thing that's crazy about it is that even as she's consciously doing that, things will come up that she doesn't expect that she then goes, holy crap, I think Paul's the Kwazit Chatterak. So she herself is then believing the prophecies that she knows were planted by somebody. And the way it looks at prophecy as something that's both, you're able to manipulate it for your own purpose, but yet on the other hand, it can still come true. Maybe that's the prophecy that had to be planted because of the big plan.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
You know, and so I loved that point because I thought that is just like how we read the Bible and our own, you know, the thing of you read the Old Testament and you can see the seeds that will flower in Jesus and our Christianity now and all this kind of stuff. And you go, yes, those guys were writing that for that time period, but there is more to it than they knew. So I just loved that look at prophecy that way.
Yeah, that is fascinating. Yeah, even in the Creed, right? In fulfillment of the prophecy, what the words are different now.
Yeah, you're right. Very good.
Yeah, but it's like, yeah, it's the same thing though. That's neat. Yeah. That's fascinating.
Yeah. Well, I always wonder, one of my absolute favorite resurrection stories is the two disciples on the road to Emmaus, and they're like, oh, I can't believe this happened. I thought he was the one. And this stranger comes up and starts going, what? So, well, didn't you hear about Jesus? And he's like, okay, you guys, let me explain to you, Old Testament style, how this fulfilled all these prophecies. And so they're talking and they're on the road and he goes to dinner with them and is still talking. And then he breaks the bread for dinner and disappears. And they're like, oh, my gosh, it was Jesus. And I always wonder, what were the things he told them? And so I look at what the church fathers say and people like Paul and, you know, in the writings of the New Testament and go, this meant this, or, you know, Matthew. And I'm like, oh, were those the things that Jesus said? Look at this. you know?
Yeah.
Or at least, you know, of course, we can find those on those things ourselves if we're reading prayerfully and look at things as a whole and in context, not just picking bits out. But I just always think about that and going, oh, my gosh. Wait, what did he say?
Oh, wow. That's cool.
And that kind of goes along with this, where Jessica's going, oh, yeah, I know that, you know, Isaiah wrote that because of the Babylonian exile. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's going, oh, wait, that applied to my life just now, that thing that person said.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we've both had that happen.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Yeah, that's so cool. Yeah, I love that. Yeah, and that ties back into that one of those, my favorite parts of that book, like you said, you know, Jessica running around in the house and Paul's the attempted assassination of Paul.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That reminds me. If you do watch the David Lynch movie, you get to see a younger Patrick Stewart yell at you for whenever he's on. Whenever he's on. Hello, Paul, you must do this. It's just so loud. Yeah. But that was in that house, too. And
oh, I saw his Gurney Halleck, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well before John Luke.
Who's a quieter yelling man? No reason.
They're like, yeah, come on, just tone it down a little.
With a cup of Earl Grey on the side.
Yeah, right.
Tea. Earl Grey.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing, too, that you, because you do get to see into these characters, even the traitors you have empathy for. I mean, of course, not Baron Harkonnen, because he is the absolute worst.
Yeah, and Baron Harkonnen, yeah, he is, yeah.
But even his puppets. You see how he has molded them and twisted them from what they could have been. And that's especially true at the end where you start to see all this doubling of the Count, who was a failed Quidditch Haderach, you know, and Fade Rotha, if that's how you say his name, who was kind of like Paul's counterpart, but it's what would have happened if the Baron or people had gotten a hold of Paul. And so you start to see all these variations out there.
Yeah.
Of where history could have gone. It's just interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. That is interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the movie, you know, Fade Rotha is played by Sting.
I know. I knew he was in that movie.
Yeah.
He's
perfectly crazy in that movie.
That works.
Well done. Well done.
Crazily awful.
Crazily awful.
Yes.
But so no, I don't really have anything else specific to say. About it. I mean, there's just so much here. But again, you know, like you said at the beginning, you know, you read it for the story. The story is really great. It just really it. All these plots upon plots and maneuvering, even during conversations, you get the thoughts of somebody who says, I think he said this for this reason.
Oh, yeah.
And I really liked some of that. And, that can get real tedious. You know, there was a Orson Scott Card series that towards the end of the series, I was like, oh, come on. I don't want to hear every thought of
talking. Move.
Yeah. So I remember, but, you know, it's kind of amazing that he may have gotten some of that from here. And then, you know, when you look at influences, I thought that was interesting, too. How, you know, the Game of Thrones, it sort of mirrors the opening of this book.
Oh, really?
Okay. Well, you know, in a way, I know you haven't read it, but, you know, one of the main things that happens very quickly early on.
Do I?
Yeah, I think you do. I don't want to spoil it if you don't want me to spoil
it. I plan to never read it unless you pick it. If you pick it,
okay, no, I'm not going to pick it. But the Ned Stark. Okay. I remember. Gosh, weren't we on a podcast?
Heard the name, but
okay. I don't remember. Well, at the very beginning of Game of Thrones, Ned Stark is the leader of House Stark, and he is pretty noble, and you know has several kids. But what happens to Leto happens to him.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
There you go. So it's kind of a parallel there.
Well, and think of how many classic stories start with that as an impetus. I mean, Hamlet, it's happened already.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we are watching Hamlet go through the same sort of choices as Paul, more gloomily and on a castle wall a lot of the time, but crazy girlfriend. But
oh, I remember we were talking about it when we were doing a podcast on Lord of the Rings with Seth. And Seth was talking about Lord of the Rings versus Game of Thrones, and I loved it because he was talking about how Ned Stark did everything right and then ended up dead. So it was like part of the message there is it doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter what you do, you're doomed, and this is the world we live in, you know.
Nothing can redeem you.
Mm-hmm.
There's no being saved.
Exactly. And it's like, opposed to Lord of the Rings, which is not that at all.
Well, and even if, and Lord of the Rings goes back to the whole sacrifice and suffering thing, is even if you just try your hardest and you don't know, but you do the right thing, you try, and that is what redeems you.
Right.
And hopefully others can use, whether you can see it or not, you know.
Exactly.
Or a mirror in the end is redeemed.
Perfect. And I love that.
Well, I would say, because the other thing that I did, and this is actually my own thought here, is that what motivates these characters a lot of the time is love. Jessica has Paul because she loves her Duke and he wants a boy and not a girl. Paul, you know, is trying to save his mother when he, and himself. But when he fights Jameson, he's doing a lot of things for his mother. His friends are motivated by love of him or, you know, his retainers or whatever you want to call them. His love for Chani is what makes him want to have a normal life. And that's what motivates a lot of us, in whether our decisions are well-informed or not, and whether Paul should have chosen something differently and didn't sacrifice himself. A lot of times I just think it's, you know, natural human stuff, but also love. And that's not dwelt upon by Frank Herbert, but especially in Jessica having Paul for her Duke. Jessica's love for her Duke is the most normal thing in the book that way. And Chani, really. And her Chani is ready to sacrifice herself so that Paul can follow his destiny.
Yeah.
And he goes to her at the end and says, well, this is a political marriage, and here's how political it is. I'll never touch her. You know?
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, that's great. That's great. I like that thought.
Yeah.
And it's true. True in life, too, right?
Exactly. Do we always make the right choices? No. But it's when we love other people more than ourselves that we are our best selves. You know.
You bet. You bet. That's right. And hopefully it'll work out.
Fingers crossed.
That's right. But now we know that if we knew what was going to happen, it wouldn't help us.
That's the other thing too. So, you know, too bad race conscious. Oh, no, wait, race conscious. Sorry, forgot that.
That's right. So there is that.
High race consciousness.
Oh, too funny. Too funny.
Well, I just once I started seeing that pop everywhere, I was like, give me a break.
Yeah.
But luckily the book is so great, it doesn't matter.
And this is one terrific book. It's so well worth it. And almost everybody that I know that has read Dune has not read past Dune. That's what I don't understand, you know, all of these Kevin J. Anderson and Brian Herbert books. They seem to be selling so well, but I don't know who buys them or who reads them. I know very few people that have. So I need to find somebody who has and see what they think.
Yeah, and I know they have their passionate fans because, again, in the Mythgard Academy things, there was somebody who kept pushing Corey Olson to reread the sequels, and Corey Olson's like, no, I've read them, you know, and eventually he very nicely said, well, maybe I'll reread them sometime. But he's just like, they don't have the value for me that this book has.
Yeah, that's what it seems. And this is perfectly standalone. You know, you don't have to continue at all.
No, because actually, and not having read the other books, but considering all the things that are here for contemplation, you kind of have everything you need. Because we can look at our own history and see people who have been elevated like that and liked or disliked by one side or the other. People who've had universal acclaim, how have they failed? And we can see that through history.
Yeah.
Right. You know, you've got Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar and all these things. We've got all those seeds of these elements. It's just, it's interesting him to take all that stuff and consider it again. So we can kind of look at it in a very well-crafted book.
Right.
Which is just super story. Like I say, I've read it many times and just for the story. So, you know, we're digging deeper, but don't feel like you've got to do that.
All right. Has our terrible purpose been completed?
I believe so.
I think so. All right.
And was it terrible? We don't know. Was it a terrible, terrible purpose?
A terrible, terrible purpose, right?
Was it purposefully terrible?
Okay, I love it.
I'll stop.
Very nice. All right. So coming up next, Lilies of the Field.
A movie. Yes.
Yes. Excellent.
Right. Have you seen it before?
No, I have not.
Okay. Nope. I've seen it once sometime in the last year. So.
I think I found it on Amazon. So, yep. So it's available. Looking forward to it.
Copy. So yeah. You can never tell where you'll find it.
Cool. All right. Well, looking forward to that. So.
Yep. Something different.
All right. And now for something completely different.
No Dante, no Dune. There may be a terrible purpose, but it's certainly a little bit more cheerfully communicated.
Everybody needs a terrible purpose.
Oh, there's a terrible purpose. Well, there's certainly a purpose. Whether it's terrible or not, we don't know.
Fantastic.
Yes.
All right, cool. Well, thanks, everybody, for listening.
Yes, thank you for putting up with me during this time period.
Oh, shoot. Have a great couple weeks. We'll see you soon.
We'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.